So this is the second in a series on the political theory of halakha. Last week we talked about charisma, and in both education and in society, and the argument I made was that charisma, Torah recognizes charisma as essential, but is also rather frightened of it, and that the political system, specifically a division into four types of authority, as reflected in Yirmiyah 2:8, where there's political, priestly, prophetic, and intellectual authority, is intended to contain charisma. So this week's topic is whether the Torah is a charisma or a constitution or a code. And I have to say that I owe that formulation to an article by Jose Faur, the Sfardi Chacham, a very interesting figure. You can Google him yourself and discover his career. He wrote an article in a book called the Samuel K. Mirsky Memorial Volume, which I obtained, but no, I no longer have, which is why that's not actually the article on the Makarot. I obtained it because the Shalvim Library bought Professor Mirsky's estate, believing that they would get this vast, diverse library, but actually they got hundreds of copies of the Samuel K. Mirsky Memorial Volume or something like that. And my friend Yehuda Glinsky was deputed to interest people in taking copies of this book off the hands of Shalvim. So he wandered around showing people the interesting articles in this so they would take the book. So that's how I met this article. And I'm happy to say that should you find a copy of the book, by all means, obtain it. I somehow left mine behind in Israel. It has two very important articles. One, this article by Professor Faur. Another, Rabbi Walter Wurzberger's original article, Covenantal Imperative, which eventually led to his book, Ethics of Responsibility, but really is that book in many ways shaped my vision of lots of aspects of Judaism. I think there's also a great article by Sachs, possibly. That may be too early, I'm not sure. Okay, so what I gave you instead was an article of almost the same title by Professor Faur, which I believe has many of the same ideas, but it's not actually the article I read originally, so I can't vouch that. I'm still assimilating it. Also, I haven't read the article in a long time. I'm still assimilating it, but he introduced the idea to me of the distinction between a constitution and a code, and which one the Torah is. Because it's tempting to think of the Torah as a code, meaning it tells you specifically what to do, right? Lots of lists of regulations. And so it's very tempting to think of the Torah as a code. And as I understood Professor Faur back then, Faur, he argued that that would be a misunderstanding of the purpose of Torah. So I want to take you through some aspects of his argument. In the first three pages of the Makarot sheet are excerpts from Professor Faur's article. Dr. Faur's article. And see if we can understand it, because he is often a difficult writer. Not always brilliant, but often difficult. And then I want to try and set out my own thesis, which I would say the conclusion is not original, but the argumentation may be. My own thesis about the way in which halakha sets up the powers of the monarchy, and argue that the way I understand halakha's establishment of the monarchy very much conforms to Professor Faur's thesis. Okay, he does not actually, he sort of makes lots of conclusory assertions about the powers of the monarchy. I'm going to try to instantiate them in a particular structure. So here's Professor Faur beginning, right? He talks about the nomocratic society. Now that is a deliberate invention, a term of his, and it's set up in opposition to what he understands as the usual understanding of the vision of halakha is as a theocratic society. The ideal halakhic state is a theocratic society, and he goes out of his way to argue that the Torah is not a theocratic society; it's a nomocratic society. In which he argues, right, the opening sentence, that law in Jewish tradition is a radical concept with no parallel in legal thought. So there's law has no parallel in legal thought. In contradistinction with other democratic systems, where the demos, or the people, as an absolute empirical object, are the ultimate source of authority, the people of Israel recognized the absolute authority of the law. The people acted as the depository of the law. Thus, Judaism may be properly described as a nomocratic system.
Concept being that laws which govern the universe reflect divine wisdom, and by knowing those laws, you accept to God. I mean, that's not a unique thing.
No, so let's set up lots of different systems, okay? We have a democratic system in which the people are the rulers, and the authority of law comes from the fact that the people choose it. You have a natural law system in which the authority of the law inheres in reality in a certain sense.
But always, or at least in classical Catholic natural, is some why that's really significant is that that means by learning the law, you learn God's.
Good. But you learn that.
It's always theocratic.
So we're going to have to distinguish it in two ways. The first thing I have to say, this is not a natural law theory, because the law we're talking about is the law of revelation, not a law derived from reason. Right? Natural law is always derived from reason or intuition or some kind of something that is internal to the right, to every human conscience. Right? And then it's claimed to be objectively universal, but he's arguing the law in Judaism is a revealed law. And yet, now why is it a nomocratic system, not a theocratic system? The reason is that God is subject to the law. Right? In the normal way in which a political system is structured, the sovereign is the source of authority of the law. But he argues that in Judaism, right, since God is subject to the law, he takes all the agadotot about God being bound by halakha with great seriousness. And therefore he says, if the system understands God as being bound by the law, then you cannot say that God is sovereign. You have to say that the law is sovereign. Yes, Leah?
It's a fun fact where it fits out.
Okay, I did not remember that, Robert Herzl. He was writing in English or in Hebrew?
Hebrew.
Right, so what are the words used in Hebrew? Aha, okay. Thank you, interesting. So that's the Tuvah Kamedini was only published fairly recently, even though it was written, right? So it may be independent evolution. His first fundamental idea is that the Torah system is set up for the law to be sovereign rather than God. He has all sorts of clever things which you can think are drash or pshat, that you're supposed to teach children Torah, Tzivon, and Moshe before you teach them Shema Yisrael. Right? All of these are embedded in particular minhagim of the Syrian community. That's doctrine number one. Doctrine number two, right, where there should be, is the notion that the purpose of law is not to restrict autonomy, but to guarantee autonomy. The purpose of law is to enable everybody to live in accordance with, and both individuals and communities, to live in fulfillment of their vision and their rights. So he says, right, that a society is autonomous when the ordering of human conduct and the adjustment of human relations are relative to its own criteria and interests. And he argues that that means that you have to recognize that the law is independent of everything else. And without the law, autonomy is not possible. So this is a classic rabbinic notion, which he pulls out, the Ein ben chorin el misha osek b'Torah. And freedom requires engagement with Torah. So that takes some steps to figure out. Why does law create freedom as opposed to limit it? And what does law create, right? And normally we think that the existence of an objective legal order is a restraint on your capacity to act autonomously. And that's why the rabbinic statement, Ein ben chorin el misha osek b'Torah, is usually seen as affirming a paradox. Right, so how does he make the argument that the... Right, he argues this is fundamentally true, which I read that everybody even plays the myth, that the purpose of the mitzvot, of the brachot, of Shalom Asani... Shalom Asani Eved are to celebrate the essential autonomy that is part of Judaism. So here again, I would be cautious because the way the Talmud frames it is that the Jews are only avadim to Hashem. Kili b'nei Yisrael avadim, lo avadim l'avadim. Jews are avadim to God, but not to other avadim. And he leaves out that pasuk, and he argues that Jews are not avodim at all, because the law is free. So that, I think, is a very, I think that is a very challenging claim, and I'm not sure that I buy the notion that it's autonomy. He tries something along the lines, which is the standard rabbinic mode of Isaiah Berlin's distinction between positive and negative freedom, that you don't have freedom from the law, you have freedom to in the law. He tries something along those lines. If you look at the bottom of the page, he says that unlike freedom, chofesh, which is a negative concept with negative connotations, for example, freedom from hunger or from oppression, autonomy, chirut, is the affirmation of certain inalienable rights contracted with God.
It's somewhat like the Marxist argument that if you understand what
the
law requires,
that's different. Yeah, the Marxists are determinists. He's not a determinist. So I would be right. So I would be very nervous about associating it. I suspect that he's very anti-Marxist. I don't know that for sure.
It's not a question of whether he's anti-Marxist. It's a question of why recognizing the law.
Yeah, but right. But the question is, Marxists recognize a law that controls you, and he recognizes a law that you choose to obey.
By choosing to obey the right law.
Okay, so right, something like that is going to have to be the argument. I don't understand exactly his particular form. Yes, Andy. Yeah, right, so that's some, right? Right, we redefine autonomy so that it does not mean freedom to live in accordance with our superficial desires. I think he's trying to do something fancier, but I confess I haven't gotten the fancier move, so I'm left with the assertion, which, as we all know, there are all sorts of ways to, all sorts of ways that we can structure it. Right, so then he argues that because the law is sovereign, so God is bound by the law, and the king is bound by the law, and this is where he tries to argue there's a sharp distinction between the American Constitution and the Jewish Constitution. The Supreme Court is bound by the law. So he wants to argue that in America, the Supreme Court can make an intellectual error, but an intellectual error is not a legal error. Right? If you follow the Supreme Court, you cannot have done something unconstitutional. The Supreme Court can change its mind, but legally, whatever the Supreme Court says is right now is not right, is not an error. Whereas, and here, you know, I'm very much after his heart, he thinks that perhaps the key paragraph in Torah is the one which says that there is a sacrifice to be brought when the Sanhedrin has been in error. If there's a sacrifice to be brought, that means that we conceive of the action as having been illegal at the time, right? The sacrifice is brought when most of the Jewish people followed the erroneous talk of the Sanhedrin. It's not the fact of the error, but the consequence of the error being that most of the people followed it. So that, he argues, means, right, if the sacrifice has to be brought for an action of the people that was done in accordance with the decision of the Sanhedrin, it has to be possible that even though the Sanhedrin ruled that way, that the action was illegal at the time. And therefore he argues that it's always the case that the authority of the Sanhedrin comes from its correctness in interpreting the law, and not from their status as the primary interpreters of the law. Right, I remember somebody named, not that one, but a relative named Yitzhak Tversky, wrote an article in Beit Yitzhak many years ago. Did the Sanhedrin find the law, discover the law, or create it? He tried to argue that the Sanhedrin creates the law. So Professor Favour here tries to argue that no, the Sanhedrin does not create the law. Rather, the Sanhedrin discovers the law. However, right now we get to the point that probably is most crucial for my presentation tonight. The position that the Sanhedrin can only discover the law and not create the law can theoretically lead to a tremendously rigid system. Because the law is. So, right, so there should only be one law. So to evade that, he says that there is a difference in the way in which constitutions and codes should be understood. Codes are designed to be as specific as possible, and ideally to admit of only one interpretation, because they're designed to shape behavior specifically. Constitutions are deliberately written in such a way that they can change and adapt to circumstances, and that they can admit of multiple interpretations in response to differing circumstances, and also so that because the parts have to adjust to each other. So what he argues is that this is the last section, the hermeneutics in rabbinic jurisprudence, that the way the Torah functions as a constitution, which means it's deliberately intended to allow for multiple interpretations, and is not trying to micromanage a society. It's trying to create a framework for a society. Now he argues this in a somewhat more radical way than I would, honestly. And he does this in the context of a much, much broader general theory of language. Those of you who really like cool but difficult literary criticism, you can read his book called Golden Doves with Silver Dots, which is his overall theory of biblical interpretation, which is really, really hard but enormously fun. But basically, he takes the position that a constitution, and the Torah specifically, should not be interpreted in accordance with any notion of original intent, because since he argues that the constitution is sovereign, and God is bound by the Torah, not vice versa. So the Torah is not, the goal of interpreting the Torah is not to understand what God meant by it. Right? God is engaged in the same process as we are of trying to figure out what the words mean, because he's bound by it as well. Right? That's the really radical notion. And at the end he says, but doesn't this mean we can make it whatever we want? So he argues that all readers of constitutions, even though there are many theories of constitutions that argue that what you're bound by is the text and not the intent of the authors, and this, of course, is a dispute in American constitutional theory as well, but there is the fact that an almost infinite array of interpretations is possible doesn't mean that there aren't some interpretations that are wrong. Right? Rav Moshe Tendler is fond of saying there are 70 interpretations of Torah, but not 71. Right? I don't think 70 or 71 matters. The point is that an infinite number of correct interpretations doesn't exclude the possibility of a finite or infinite number of wrong interpretations. And this, by the way, for those of you who are literary criticism aficionados, this is also an argument that Professor Jeffrey Hartman in Yale used to make, that even deconstructionists believe that there's such a thing as falsifying a text, even though they think that text can mean anything, but not that. So he argues that the way you falsify a text is when you undermine its fundamental nature. So to interpret a constitution in such a way that it's not a constitution, to interpret a constitution in such a way that it doesn't preserve the authority of law is against the text. So the thing you have to, the given is, you have to interpret the constitution, the Torah, in such a way that enables there to be binding halakha. Because that's what gives it its authority, is that it's the source of authority. So what he ends up with is a system in which ultimately every aspect of authority in Torah has to be subordinate to the true interpretation of the Torah. And that raises, that ultimately makes everyone autonomous, because ultimately you can only be bound by your interpretation of Torah. And if other people get it wrong, then you're entitled to tell them that. Right? There's no way in which they say, I got it right and you got it wrong, right? Because I'm me. That doesn't work. Right? All of you are subordinate to law, and if the Sanhedrin gets it wrong and you get it right, then you're entitled to say that. There are rules, right, in which your own interpretation about how you handle conflicts of interpretation between yourself and the Sanhedrin, but ultimately, right, each of you has direct access to the source of authority. But in order to prevent that from yielding a rigid system in which there is only one interpretation, he thinks that there are many areas of Torah in which all that is a given of the text is a range. And within that range, the text can mean many things, and any area where the text can mean many things, then there can be authority. And as long as it's a given that this is one of the possible meanings of the text, so then we can say that the one that the Sanhedrin chooses is the binding, right, is the binding law. Okay, I don't know how he squares that entirely with his notion of autonomy, right? Because now he's diminished autonomy. So I think that, at least so far as I can see it, that is the weakest part of his thesis. Okay, but that's yes, Harry. Sanhedrin can change his mind because if it was wrong, it has to. And he can change his mind again. But it does it by saying that it was wrong. Right, so it has to admit error, it has to take responsibility for all the sins it caused, and eventually that will diminish its authority dramatically. Right, any Sanhedrin that, you know, that flip-flops every 2 days, people will stop following. So so, on the what he argues is on the fundamental level, no. Right, on the fundamental level, it should not be possible for something to be wrong then and right now. Either it's a possible meaning of the text or it's not. It could be that one interpretation is the law then, and is not the law now, if it was in the area that was deliberately ambiguous. Right, I think that's the distinction he tries to draw, and in this, I think he is legitimately coming directly from the Rambam. Right, the Rambam argues that there are what he calls halachot l'Moshe Mi-Sinai. Now, halachot l'Moshe Mi-Sinai for the Rambam means the interpretations of the Torah that are inarguable. Right, this is what the text has to mean. And then he has the things derived by the Yud Gimel Midot, which he thinks can be changed by fiat. Right, the Rambam thinks that there's no notion, the Rambam thinks that in principle there's no notion of precedent in laws derived by biblical interpretation. That the rabbis can get up one day and say that it's this, and the next day they can get up and say it's that, and that's fine. They don't have to admit error, they can just say yesterday this was right, and today that was right. What they can't do is say that the Torah doesn't mean what it meant yesterday. On the fundamental level, you know, the way I like to describe it is that the Halachah L'Moshe Mi-Sinai incorporates biblical Hebrew, and all of desert Israelite culture. So what the words meant to what the words would have meant to them is fixed. But if their sentences would have been ambiguous back then too, so then we have right. This is very, very much opposed to notions that, you know, that there's revelation over time, and that right, and or anything like that. Right, I think that it's a rigid notion that the words of the Torah mean certain things, they'll always mean certain things, but that they mean certain things doesn't mean that they have definite implications legally. Yes, ma'am. Yeah, Dvar Halacha is, right, Dvar Halacha, so part of what the Torah does is it gives authority to legislate, and you can legislate, but then people have to decide, are you in fact within your authority as a legislator in doing this, or are you going beyond the scope of? Right, are you, you know, the same as the miracle? Is this actually legislation intended to execute the law, right, or is it reaching into the powers reserved to the people? My favorite illustration of this is Rabbi Norman Lamb used to give an annual shiur in memory of Dr. Belkin at YU. It was his big annual shiur. It was always enormous amounts of fun, but because we're such a good speaker, so you have to wait several days before to think about it and then go back over it again in order to tell whether it made sense or not, because when he was speaking, it always made sense. But nonetheless, that was only to the students. The Rosh Yeshiva would then, everyone would have to come, and then the Rosh Yeshiva would rebut in their shiur after his shiur. It was enormous amounts of fun. So the first one I went to, which was enormous amounts of fun, it's in his book, Halichos v'Halachos. He takes on the first Mishnah in Brachot, So in the first Mishnah in Brachot, there's a three-way machloket, Rabbi Eliezer, the Chachamim, and Rabbi Gamliel. Rabbi Eliezer says that Kriyat Shema can only be Kriyat Shema at night can only be said till 10. Rabbi Gamliel, the Chachamim say till midnight. Rabbi Gamliel says till Alot HaShachar. And Rabbi Gamliel's sons end up following him. And the Gemara says, right, they ask him what to do, and he says, you can follow me and say Kriyat Shema. In fact, you have to say Kriyat Shema if it's not yet morning. So it's not Rabbi Lam's original question. Why did the sons really not know his position? Presumably, Rabbi Gemara asked, right? Didn't the sons know Rabbi Gamliel's position? Of course they knew his position. So what were they asking? They were asking, since they're the majority and you're the minority, so are we allowed to follow you or not? So now the question is, why are we allowed to, what, right? He says, yes, you're allowed to follow me, and they decide that they're allowed to follow him. So why are they allowed to follow a minority position? So Rabbi Lam has this amazing claim that the Rambam, in his introduction to Mishnah Torah, cites references two different sources of rabbinic authority to legislate, one of which is just v'shamru et mishmarti, the other is ki palei mimcha davar, if something is too difficult for you. Right, then, and he argues that according to the position that the authority to legislate is derived from ki palei mimcha davar, if the matter is too difficult for you, it would follow that there is no authority to legislate on unless there is a relevant biblical ambiguity. And Rabbi Gamliel held that in this particular pasuk, there was no relevant ambiguity, because since he and the Chachamim agreed that actually deoraita, the mitzvah is all night. That being the case, Rabbi Gamliel denied the Chachamim's. Not only did he disagree with their legislation, he denied their authority to legislate. And if he denied their authority to legislate, then the rules of majority-minority rule don't apply. And that's how his sons could follow him, right? How he could tell them to follow him, because when you deny authority, then all the rules, the majority rule goes out the window. There is, when there is a biblical ambiguity. No. As long as it is a pasuk in which there is an ambiguity, then you can make a siyag. Okay, I'm not right. In the first Mishnah in Brachot, it's impossible, because the whole point of the first Mishnah in Brachot is there's a machloket Rabbi Gamliel and Rabbi Eliezer about what the pasuk means. Right, so the claim there's no ambiguity is impossible, but it's still brilliant and fun. Yes. Okay. That's the long introduction. That one, I think I might have noticed that at the time, or I might have noticed it 3 days later that it was impossible in the Mishnah. But okay. So I want to take all these positions and say, how does it play out in our, what we might call our practical messianic political theory? What do we think that the ultimate, in the Jewish utopia, right, the Messiah comes, right, what is the authority of the king? Is it really true that we live in that the king is subordinate to law? And do we have a rigid political system? Or do we have a constitution which enables the powers of the king to be set up in multiple ways? Right, so that's what I'm testing this thesis. So I'm going to try and do it in a way that is not my normal mode. I'm going to do intellectual history and try and show a certain pattern in the way in which the laws of kingship develop. And we'll see if you buy the thesis at the end of it.